Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, here with
Susan Franzen. Thank you for joining us and listening in. We have a damp day today in the high 30s and low 40s with slight chance of snow. By tonight, it'll get down to the teens and with a wind chill as low as 5 degrees. Tuesday should remain cold and overcast. Sun is expected to return on Wednesday with rising temperatures into the 40s, and expect that pretty much for the rest of the week through Sunday with the same sun and the same cloudy skies. So we have wintry temperatures, but no real snow on the immediate horizon. Ursula, what Iowa news stories do you have with us from the past week?
Here's a summary of some state news brought to you by the Iowa Informer, iowainformer.com. Iowa senior senator Chuck Grassley was criticized for remarking to the Des Moines Register that ending the estate tax would value those who invest their money over those, quote, those that are just spending every darn penny they have, whether it's on booze or women or movies, end of quote. Grassley was consequently dropped from the congressional committee tasked with negotiating tax reform deal between the House and the Senate. He announced the news on Twitter, messaging President Trump directly. Quote, I'm the most senior member of the Senate Finance Committee, he wrote. Quote, I was dropped as conferee, so I won't be in the front line fighting for what you and I believe to cut taxes. Iowa Senators Grassley and Joni Ernst both supported the controversial tax reform bill being rushed through the upper chamber. It would end the Affordable Care Act's individual health care mandate, allow for drilling in Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge, raise taxes on graduate students, and benefit the wealthy over the middle class. Meanwhile, the Washington, D.C.-based Environmental Working Group reported that Grassley is one of seven members of Congress who have received a combined $15 million over the past two decades in federal assistance from farm policies they supported. Grassley has received nearly $370,000 in commodity subsidies since the mid-90s, including disaster corn, soybean, and oat commodity subsidies. Writing for The Guardian, former farmer Debbie Weingarten recently reported on how farmers have been committing suicide at a rate more than double that of military veterans and currently higher than that of people in any other job. The Northern Iowa radio station KIOW-FM fired two employees after making insensitive, thoughtless, and degrading, unquote, remarks about high school basketball players from Eagle Grove with Latino-sounding names. The comments were made on an online video service broadcasting before a game between Eagle Grove and hometown Forest City team. The announcers who were fired were Orrin Harris and board operator Holly Jane Cusero-Smith, who later resigned from her position as a third-grade teacher over the controversy. After the two called the basketball players, quote, foreigners, Harris remarked, as Trump would say, go back where they came from. Cusero-Smith replied, well, some would say that, yeah, some days I feel like that, too. A video of their conversation went viral on Facebook. On Friday, Congressman Steve King made another comment on Twitter reflecting the views of white nationalists, writing, diversity is not our strength. Once again, quoting the authoritarian Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, saying, mixing cultures will not lead to a higher quality of life, but a lower one. In response, Democrats and other critics of King called on Governor Kim Reynolds to condemn the congressman's remarks because he serves as a co-chair of her 2018 gubernatorial campaign. They got no response, although Jeff Kaufman, the chairman of the Iowa GOP, indirectly reacted to King's tweet with a quote from Ronald Reagan, who said that Americans were, quote, filled with the spirit of our land in all of its magnificent diversity, unquote, and, quote, our nation was built by the hopes of all humanity. And that is some of last week's news from the state of Iowa, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. For more information, go to iowainformer.com. Thank you, Gavin.
Vesham tota nizabeah.
and you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Susan Franson. Hanukkah starts tomorrow, December 12th. Back in 2012, when we were just starting out here at KHOI, John Pleasance and Sally LaPan from the Ames Jewish Congregation were kind enough to come in and explain the Hanukkah story. This is what they shared. John began the interview by identifying the historical period from which the Hanukkah story stems.
In 167 BCE, which means before the Common Era, the Jews that were in what we call Israel now were under the rule of Syrians.
The Judea was ruled by Assyrian Greeks following Alexander, who conquered the area. Alexander the Great was very interested in Judaism and was willing for Jews to continue their religious practices. However, Alexander the Great died when he was 32 years old, and his subsequent rulers did not share his views.
And so the whole region was sort of what we call Hellenized or sort of Greek-like. Part of what was happening was imposed on the Jewish people, but part of it was something the Jewish people at that time started getting into themselves. So they were starting to become Hellenized and forgetting their original practices. Basically, the Jews were becoming more secular.
And eventually, Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, came to be ruler, and he decided that peoples were no longer allowed to practice their own religions. They all needed to adopt the Greek religion. However, there were a number of Jews who continued to practice the Jewish religion and were opposed to Jews who were following Greek ways. And eventually, a priest named Mattathias rebelled, rose up together with his sons, and over a period of 3 years, this guerrilla war prevailed. And when eventually Mattathias's sons were victorious in their guerrilla war, they immediately wanted to get rid of the statue of Zeus and the temple in Jerusalem, anything that defiled the holiness of the temple. And they wanted to rededicate it to the Jewish God. Hanukkah grew out of that. Hanukkah means rededication.
Another story gets attached to this, has been tied into the historical story. There's one of the things that's in the synagogue is something called the Ner Tamid, which is the eternal light. And so it's always burning there. Well, they didn't have enough oil for this light to keep burning. And so all they had was oil for one day.
When the Jews got into the temple, they wanted to rekindle the great menorah, but they could only find one small cruse of oil. And it was not enough oil for the oil to burn for 8 days and nights. But they took a chance and went ahead and used the oil to kindle the lights on the menorah. And miraculously, the oil lasted, hence the celebration. Now, I emphasize that this legend of the oil does not appear in any Jewish literature until several hundred years after the events. And some people think that this legend was developed to take the emphasis away from the guerrilla warfare, because at the time that the legend came into being, Jews were a subjugated group, but they wanted to continue practicing their religion. And by taking the emphasis away from the guerrilla warfare, the rebellion, and the success of it, and emphasizing the rededication of the temple and the miracle of the lights, they felt that they would be in a better position to continue practicing their religion under foreign domination.
Can you explain what the menorah is?
The best word I can think of is to describe it as a candelabra. However, candles did not exist in ancient times, so it was oil that was used to produce light. It was a fairly substantial object. I'm not sure if it stood on the ground, but I envision it as being at least 3 feet tall and maybe taller than that. And the reason I say that is because when the Romans conquered Jerusalem in the year 70 CE, they took that menorah back to Rome. And we have a frieze from that time period that shows this huge menorah being dragged by the Roman soldiers.
And what was the purpose of the menorah?
I don't know, but it was a it was in the temple, so it must have had some special significance in that temple. Our Hanukkah is a special type of menorah that's only used at Hanukkah. And our Hanukkah actually has 8 branches in addition to 1 helper, because we have 8 nights of Hanukkah. So there is 1 holder for each candle for each night of Hanukkah. And then because those candles are not to be seen as actually providing light for work, there needs to be a separate candle for lighting those, the sort of the worker candle, or the shamash is what we call it.
The first night, you would light your shamash candle and you'd light 1 candle. And then the next night, you would light your shamash candle and 2 candles, and so on, till you get through all 8. The miracle of Hanukkah is that this oil that should have lasted only for 1 day actually lasted for 8 days. There's a blessing associated with the lighting of the candles. We light candles every night of Hanukkah, and we fry things like latkes and donuts on Hanukkah to commemorate the oil that was associated with it.
And latkes are?
Latkes are potato pancakes. Originally, there would be some small gifts for kids that would be given out at this time, and there's a little game involving something called a dreidel, which is like a top that kids would play. Certainly now, in competition with Christmas, the gift-giving part has now been ramped up to make them feel a little bit better about the whole season. So Hanukkah has clearly taken on a level of importance far beyond what it was originally. And again, there are some parallels with Christmas in that the 25th of Kislev is when Hanukkah starts, and it's the 25th of December when Christmas is. So there's some borrowing that took place there.
Thank you for that explanation of the Hanukkah story. That was Sally LePin and John Pleasance from the Ames Jewish Congregation. Happy Hanukkah! This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am Susan Franzen, one of your hosts, here with Ursula Rudenberg. Last week, while exploring this year's Christmas season, I went to the North Grand Mall to check out the indoor farmers market. I went on a day when the market wasn't open, so I spoke with Dick DeMoss, manager of the market, in the space where the market was going to be held. Many of the stalls were covered, so it didn't look very festive yet. The most prominent sign said, DeMoss Pumpkin Farm. Dick DeMoss told me a little about how the farm got started and what their business is now. I heard about how he started, and this was a good introduction. But I really needed to come back last weekend to find out how the variety of vendors made the farmer's market into a Christmas market. You'll hear first from Dick in our recording, and then from his wife, Letha, with a popcorn machine going in the background. It was a lot livelier on Saturday. And finally, from a couple of the more colorful vendors. If you're curious, it's at the end of the mall near Penny's.
The North Grand Farmers Market, of course, is featured in part because of our Shop Local programs about this time of year. But Farmers Market is not only a local merchant, but it's a lot of local merchants. All your goods that you're selling, your baked goods, your baskets, your caramel corn, your gems and jellies, honey.
DeMoss Pumpkin Farm started 43 years ago. I was a 4-H leader, and our daughter was 9 years old. So she was a clover bud, what they call clover bud, first year 4-H. And it's grown into way more than what we'd ever thought. It was like 10 foot square, and now we have, you know, up to 16, 18 acres of things that we grow. Well, we always left it with the pumpkin farm, but it should be DeMoss Produce Farm because we have so much stuff. And your second question is, yes, we do still have sugar sweet, that's a variety, sugar sweet variety pie pumpkins to sell.
And right now.
Right now. And we're still selling them almost every day. We sell those pumpkins. They're pumpkins that are designed especially for pies. They're fine textured, and they're not too big, about 4 pounds, 4 to 5 pounds. And you'll get 2 pies out of one pumpkin. They're easy to work with. You don't have to skin them. The skin and all goes into your pie.
Now, I see you have honey. Who produces your honey?
Well, we have bees, because anything that is on a vine, we need a bee to pollinate. And so if we have bees, well, we'll have fruit on our vines. If we don't have bees, we won't have fruit on the vine. So bees are important to food production, but it's also, we just have to have bees. That's all there is to it.
And so if they're around, why, they just have to make honey, right?
That's right, yeah. They have to go from the male blossom to the female blossom and impregnate that blossom, and then that blossom then has the fruit.
So what fruits do you grow?
Well, we've got a long list. Start in the spring with lettuce and radishes, carrots. We plant about 900 onions. We plant 650 tomato plants, 6 acres of sweet corn in the summer. We have 1,100 hills of asparagus. Forgot about that. That's the first thing that's ready. April 20th is the magic date that asparagus will be ready. So we start then, and all these other things fall in line so that when one is about done, another one will take over. And we go all summer long like that, clear to Christmas. We're busy 20 hours a day.
And all of these plants have to be pollinated by bees?
If it's a vine crop or a blossom crop, then it has to have an insect or a bee, and hopefully it's not an insect, to go from the male blossom to the female and impregnate that female.
So you named a lot of things. I presume lettuce and radishes and carrots don't need pollination.
They don't need bees, no.
But strawberries and raspberries do.
Oh, yeah. Cucumbers, squash, watermelon, pumpkins, apples, cherries, all the fruits have to have bees. Most of those vegetables require to be pollinated by an insect or a bee.
What about tomatoes?
Tomatoes will get some bee activity also. Even, you know, if you get down sort of technical, the wind is a pollinator too, that it can blow pollen from the male to the female blossom. And so we don't worry too much about tomatoes, but the vine crops certainly have to have bees.
I'm Letha DeMoss. We're part of the DeMoss Pumpkin Farm, and yes, I bake and I bake and I bake. My second life is in the kitchen. We had an order last night for 22 loaves, so I went home after here and baked again. So I finished up again last night at 2 o'clock. And I baked probably 25 dozen cookies this morning, and I'll start in again tomorrow.
And it looks like most of the cookies are gone.
Yeah, there's a few left over there, but not a lot, and not a lot of the baked goods. To the average person, it looks like a lot. To me, it looks like I'm almost out. So it's a hard job, but people enjoy it, so we just keep baking.
Now, who takes care of your beehives?
We have a family from down near Perry, and they bring the bees to the farm, and they draw the honey off. Both Dick and I are allergic to the bees, Dick especially. And I take no chances, because probably 3-4 years ago, I got attacked by the bees and was stung over 40 times. So no more bees. I give them lots of room now.
But from what Dick said, you need those bees.
We need the bees for pollination. If the bees don't have to fly as far, we get better pollination. So people don't understand the importance of the bees, but they're we need them for our food.
So the honey that you're selling is actually made by the person who brings you the bees.
Exactly, yes. We have the bees on the farm, and they draw the honey off, get it ready for us, and then we can sell it. So It's a win-win for both of us.
Well, so I'm going to talk to Belinda Merritt over here, surrounded by tie-dye. It's really pretty intriguing looking. I can see shirts for women. I can see tiny little shirts. And I can see socks. So what do you have?
Well, I have all sizes from newborn up to adult, 4 extra large. I have shirts. I have aprons in 4 different sizes from little kids up to what I call adult deluxe, which is more or less a size for men or maybe a plus size. I have socks in all different sizes from 0 to 3 months up to men's extra large. I also have ladies' socks and children's socks. I have a variety of linens, tablecloth, queen-size sheets. I have washcloths, pillowcases, dish towels. I have ladies' underwear. I have, and the shirts, I have both short sleeve and long sleeve. Some are t-shirts, some are thermal, some are denim shirts. I have quite a variety. I dye all of these at home in my own kitchen. Beats cooking.
Thanks, Belinda. Hello. Do you come down from Amana with these?
No, I live here in Ames. These Amish families live in Lamoni area, southern Iowa and northern Missouri, right along I-35.
And do you sell also in the summer or only in the winter?
In the summer at farmers markets from May through October, and then some craft shows in the winter also, and then the indoor market.
Could you describe these for a radio listener?
Sure. Everything here, the products are handcrafted by Amish families, and most of the baskets are signed and dated, and then what makes them extra special is if the children weave, they put their age on there, and they might be age 5, 6, 10, 12, because they see their family members weaving, and so they weave also. They don't do the cutting and the nailing, but they do the weaving of the baskets. And then the rugs are woven on a loom by a young Amish woman and another Amish family, and they are machine washable. And hanger lay flat. Aprons and pot holders are sewn on a treadle sewing machine because these are old order Amish. No electricity, no running water. They travel by horse and buggy. And this is the way they support their families by making these products.
This is Local Talk on KHOI, where we bring you people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We have taken a peek into the North Grand Mall Farmers Market, and tomorrow, Tuesday, December 12th, the Ames Public Library continues its ongoing series of talks by authors of special interest to Iowa audiences. I spoke with the author who will be there tomorrow and can bring you this preview. Linda Betzinger-McCann, we are just previewing her new book, The Civilian Conservation Corps in Northeast Iowa. Why did you choose just to do Northeast Iowa?
Well, we are planning that I will do the whole state with the CCC, but there's just so much information out there that to put it in affordable form, you know, I'm just going to have to do a part at a time, a section of the state at a time.
Of course, I'm sure anybody who's been to a national park has seen the work of the CCC, but I think many of our listeners will be surprised to know that there was a lot of work done by the CCC in Iowa. So why don't you tell us how you discovered this and what you discovered?
Well, I had grown up hearing about the CCC and, of course, had visited state parks and knew about them. Well, I did a newspaper interview with about a 30-year-old guy, and he knew nothing about the CCC, had no clue anything about it. But my publisher said, next is the CCC. And so, again, we went into it thinking 2 books. Well, they'll either be 4 or 5 now, because, again, there's so much information that we're not, all of us aren't aware of.
Was this exclusively building projects, like bridges and that we see in the national parks, or was it the kind of work we now call conservation?
Well, the CCC was mainly working on natural resources. In Iowa, 75% of their work projects actually dealt with soil erosion. And this is what I did not know. And I think that's the thing. Most of us don't see this, so we don't know anything about it. But they did the soil erosion, and they worked on our state parks, is what the CCC did.
Well, for those who don't know about the founding of the CCC, why we did this, it wasn't just because we had a concern with conservation in the 30s, right?
Right. These were the Depression years, and there was a real shortage of jobs for the young men who, some of them, had never had a job other than what they could find picking up, you know, part-time on the fly. One guy I talked to that had gone into the CCC was diving for clamshells in the Mississippi River, and he was making a penny a shell for what he recovered. And he was the only one in his family earning wages. So the Depression was going on. There was no place for people to get work. There were no place for them to get help. And the CCC was that source.
When we talked before, you said that some people were ashamed of being in the CCC.
Well, and I've even run into that with the guy that I mentioned earlier. He said I could tell his story. He did not want me to use his name. And as I kind of paused and thought about it, he added, I don't want my family thinking poorly of my father. This guy's 97 years old, and yet he's still thinking of his father.
Why would people think poorly of his father? Because he was doing something that was necessary and really pretty heavy work.
Well, yeah, the work was very hard. But the father, according to how people looked at it, and I recently had a woman come to one where I was speaking, and she said this was a government handout. And I said, no, it was not. These men were paid $30 a month. And 25 of it went home to their families. They did not see the $25 at all. Well, people thought of that the father could not support the family, so it was a handout. Even though these guys worked very, very hard for their money, it's still, even now, people consider this a handout.
This is pretty amazing that even in Iowa, there were many of these projects that were very visible, weren't there? Like at the ledges, there was...
Right. They worked at ledges. They worked around Des Moines in several of the parks. You know, all over Pilot Knob in North Iowa, down around Winterset and Knoxville. Every part of the state had a camp, and each camp had about 200 guys in it doing whatever they needed to do.
What kinds of things did they do for the soil erosion?
There they did terracing. They built dams. They built dikes. Pretty much anything to help renew the black soil. In 1930, it said we had no forests in Iowa. I have trouble every time I say that, and everybody I say it to has trouble believing it also. But these CCC guys planted about 30 million trees in Iowa.
Wow, that is very impressive. So when we talk about preserving our forests, these are definitely not old-growth forests.
Right. The CCC completely planted Yellow River State Forest in northeast Iowa, Shimmick and Stephen State Forest in southeast Iowa. 12,000 acres in those three forests were completely planted by the CCC.
How did they know what to do? Who directed this work?
Iowa State was involved with a lot of it, answering questions, making recommendations, that sort of thing. And when they were working with farmers, they, of course, did what was recommended to renew the soil, and then they planted trees to hold the soil. So, you know, they had so many people involved. It's truly unreal to think about how they did all this. I've talked with 16 guys that were in the CCC, and one day one of the guys said to me, how do you think we planted trees? And I kind of looked at it and I went, with a shovel, you know? And he said he and 40 guys would stand in a straight line, an arm's length apart. They would plant the first tree at their foot. They would take two steps, check that they were fairly sure, plant the next tree. And he said, we did this for 8 hours a day, days after days after days.
And they were embarrassed to tell people about it.
They were. Even now, I had a very good friend that came to me. She had found a notebook about 3 inches thick, full of pictures, and she did not know her father had been in the CCC. And yet this book was full of pictures of his experience. Unfortunately, she didn't find it till he died, and any memories were lost.
Did she hesitate to share that because he might have not wanted anyone to know?
No, she was very willing for people to know, and she wanted to know more because, again, there's these stories out there that none of us have heard. She wanted it known. She wanted to find as much as she could so she could share it with her kids and grandkids. And I am finding that the guys are ready to talk to me, but at times they don't want their family there when they talk to me. So again, it's just so surprising to us.
So you said you have so much material, you have to do 5 books?
Probably 4 or 5. This is the northeast corner. It's roughly north of 30 and east of 35. My book on the southeast is going to be out about the 15th of December, and I am just in the process of finishing up the central part of the state, which includes Ames and Des Moines and Ledges, Boone, all this sort of thing. And then I will go to the western part of the state. And
you're coming to Ames on Tuesday,
right?
The 12th. You'll be at the Ames Public Library at 7 p.m. And will you have books with you?
I will. I will have copies of all my books, but I'll definitely have CCC books with me.
And we can eventually look forward to reading a book about our area.
I'm hoping for next summer. And I would love anyone that has had family members in the CCC or remembers it to come and share stuff with me, because there's always more stories out there I haven't heard yet.
What's the best way to get in touch with you besides going to the Ames Public Library next Tuesday?
Probably my cell phone, and that is 319-239-7071.
And will you have contact information on your website?
I do have some. The other thing is they can call my publisher directly. It's 800-765-1690. And they'll be able to order books right from there, too.
Okay. Well, we'll have that information on our website. Maybe not your cell phone number, but certainly a link to your editor.
Great.
And your publisher. And thank you so much, Linda. That was Linda Bensinger-McCann.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. And this is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Linda McCann with telling about her new book, The Civilians Conservation Corps in Northeast Iowa.
We are your hosts for today. I am Ursula Rudenberg, here with Susan Franson, and Keith Morgan, Story County's Emergency Management Coordinator, has joined us for his monthly check-in.
Good morning.
Good to have you back. Now, last month, we decided after the show that this time around you would bring us an example of a real-life emergency response situation that really happened. So to that end, you brought some special guests with you today. Would you introduce them?
Sure. We've got Dr. Locke Carricker and also Dr. Justin Brown. They're both from the Veterinary Diagnostic and Production Animal Medicine out at Iowa State, and they've been a real big help to emergency management.
Okay, so what is the incident that you guys are going to tell us about?
We're going to talk about a animal transport rollover. A lot of people wouldn't even consider that to be an emergency that we would have to deal with, but they do occur, and they've actually occurred a lot more often than I would have thought. This was actually.
So what exactly is a rollover?
That's where these animal transport trailers that you see, due to some incident, they're on their side.
And they fall over.
They fall over. Most of the time it's that the truck has run off the road. Sometimes it's due to weather. Sometimes it's due to the driver falling asleep or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it really is quite a complex response when we have to do one of these.
A lot of living beings involved.
Yes. Uh-huh. There's the human element, there's the animal element, and we're trying to balance safety, animal welfare, mm-hmm. and getting a road open. All three of those things are going on mm-hmm. at the same time.
So what incident are you going to talk about here?
Well, this is actually the third one that we had. It started at 6:45 in the morning with a call to me from the Ames dispatch. They requested that I come on out and assist them with a rollover. The truck was coming off of I-35 southbound going on to Highway 30 eastbound, and it didn't negotiate the curb properly, and it had rolled on its side. So,
and when was this?
This was in April of about a year and a half or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see, that's probably one of our most busy intersections in all of Story County.
Absolutely.
And another thing a lot of people wouldn't consider is that's right in the seam of all these different jurisdictions that might be involved in it. You have the Iowa State Patrol. We had Ames Fire Department that was out there. We had the Ames Police Department that was out there. We had Story County Sheriff's deputies that were all playing in this event when I got the call at that time.
Do you know how the accident was reported?
I don't know exactly how it came into dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
There was multiple layers of response on it. The driver was okay, which was great, but here we had a trailer that the top part of it was pointing towards Highway 30 eastbound, and the wheels were towards the off-ramp, and we had a bit of a problem there to figure out.
That's a relatively steep embankment, too, right?
It is.
Yeah,
and
it's
that's one of the problems is that you've got the trailer's on its side, and it's on a steep embankment. You've got quite a few animals that are alive. It was reported at first that 40 to 60 animals at about 100 weight, and I'm not a producer, but that didn't sound right to me. But you just respond. You get out there, and you try and figure out what's going on. And that's pretty typical of these kinds of responses. What first comes in is not what you actually see when you get on scene.
And again, the animals you're talking about here are hogs, right?
Yes, they were hogs. We even had 4 to 6 of them that were loose out and out and about that we had to corral.
Mm.
But we got all of those agencies were out there. When I arrived on scene, one of the things that I started to think about is we've got to get the animals out of there as quickly as possible. If we did have a delay in trying to get some more transportation in there, what were we going to do with it?
Mm-hmm. Before you get into that, I'm just, since we're talking about emergency response, I'm trying to visualize how exactly all these different agencies that you're describing, how they all ended up there. Is there one person that contacts all these agencies, or does this kind of happen independent of each other?
What we have, it's called the Incident Command System. NIMS is another term for it, National Incident Management System. It's all built upon somebody being in charge. So the first person on scene, the first agency, in this case it probably would have been law enforcement, arrives on scene. They do a situational assessment, and then they decide what other resources are going to be needed.
Uh-huh.
Law enforcement doesn't have the equipment to be able to extract people from vehicles and things like that. So they arrive on scene, and then they would make a request for fire department support for them. If there's injuries, then they'll request medical at that time. Sometimes we just dispatch that as a package because mm-hmm. we know if there's an accident that there's a high likelihood that people might be injured, then they'll go ahead and respond with both fire and medical, even in the outer areas where we don't have full-time departments.
And as the emergency management coordinator, what is your role in that?
Well, it's one of those things that hopefully most of the time the jurisdictions can take handle the situation completely on their own. In this situation, it just so happens one of the firefighters had seen a presentation I'd given at the Homeland Security Conference about a previous animal transport accident and realized that, well, there's a guy out there with a little bit more expertise than we have on it. Let's get him in here, and if nothing else, he can be, a bit of advice as we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
They also had called Iowa State University because
– Speaking of expertise.
Expertise, because they knew that they had the expertise and that it was going to be much more – most of the firefighters in law enforcement don't know much about treating animals that have been injured.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very fortunate they made that call immediately, and they pretty much met us out on scene at that time.
Uh-huh.
So when I showed up, these guys showed up, I started to arrange. We actually have a memorandum of understanding with the county fairgrounds that if we needed to store animals, that we could move them out there. So We alerted them that we might possibly have to do that, and we also brought out the animal control officer for this county just to have some of their powers available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And Iowa State showed up on scene, and I'll turn it over to them as to what they saw and how they approached the process.
And again, when you say these guys, you're referring to the two veterinary doctors that are here with us in the room from the Iowa State.
Certainly.
From Iowa State Veterinary Medicine.
Yep. Yeah, we actually we received the call from a number of different sources. And so within the College of Veterinary Medicine, I think species specialties are fairly well understood. And so those calls eventually funneled to us in the swine group, and since that was a species involved. And so then our first step was to round up individuals that were available to respond and to help out. And then we quickly gathered the supplies that we might need based on our experience in the past.
What kind of supplies do you need?
Well, you need a number of things. One, you need penning and gating. You need equipment to restrain the animals potentially. You need veterinary equipment and supplies in case animals are injured or in some cases require humane euthanasia depending on the circumstances. You really have to be prepared for about anything you might encounter on site. And so we collect those resources. We usually have one individual who we have looped into the situation that remains back at the College of Vet Med. That individual can help us out with additional supplies and resources as we discover what we need on the scene. And then we head out and try to make contact with whoever the incident commander is and start to assess as safely as possible what the situation is for the animals and how we can respond and help out with that.
So when you got there, what did you encounter?
Well, when we got there, the animals, first of all, we were a little skeptical about the initial reports of size and number because that's not an age or size or number of animals that are routinely transported. So we sort of assumed we were dealing with a larger number of bigger animals. When we got there, that's what we discovered. We were able to observe the location of the truck. It was completely on its side. We observed while safety precautions were taken to make sure it was safe to enter and approach the vehicle. We knew that there were four or five animals that were free, and it turns out that there had been a group responding from one of the ISU farms, and those animals were already basically penned again in a trailer.
And the animals inside the truck, they were kind of piled on top of each other, or what happens?
Yeah, frequently what happens is basically the way most of these trucks are designed in terms of dimensions, when you turn them on their side, the animals have about half as much floor space as they mm-hmm. would have had now. And mm-hmm. so they're usually piled on top of each other. They're obviously frightened. They're excited. And so our goal is to try and alleviate that situation as quick as we can because as animals pile up and the truck is unable to dissipate their body heat, then potentially have consequences of that.
Like suffocation?
Suffocation can be one, potentially. Sometimes mm-hmm. heat can overcome the animals as well. There are mm-hmm. physical injuries, too, depending on exactly what happened in the wreck mm-hmm. itself. And mm-hmm. So those are all things that we have to be prepared for. And then we begin triaging animals and determining which ones could potentially be loaded safely onto another trailer to go to their original destination, or animals that need some sort of veterinary intervention in order to address mm-hmm. their situation.
So to do that, do you physically go into the truck and with the hogs?
Yep, we physically go into the truck. And so,
is that dangerous?
Well, we work with the local resources to make sure it's that we've eliminated as much danger as possible. I think mm-hmm. when you have large, scared animals, we learn in the veterinary world that there's always some danger associated with that. And so we try to mitigate that as best we can, and we rely on the first responders to secure the scene.
So they go in with you to protect you if there's problems? Or
usually the fewer folks that are actually inside, the better, because mm-hmm. there are fewer things for the animals who are already excited to react to. And so mm-hmm. what we're really counting on them for is securing the scene, making sure that the trailer itself can't shift further or create an mm-hmm. additional hazard that way. And then we'll enter and we'll manage and interact with the animals.
So I'm trying to visualize what you actually did. You went in there and you led animals out, or what?
In this particular example, we actually, the responding personnel cut a hole in the roof of the trailer, actually a couple of holes. We backed some trailers that responded, some smaller pig design trailers up to those areas, and we walked the animals off that were okay, that could walk and that didn't have substantial injuries. And so that cleared out space for us to operate then, at which point we began to evaluate the animals that had injuries or were reluctant to move for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. And that shows the interaction, because it was our fire department that opened up the top of the trailer and allowed them the opportunity then to move the other animals out. That's why law enforcement is taking care of making sure the traffic is still flowing, but it's flowing safely. Mm-hmm. At times they had to stop traffic completely as we backed in the trailers. It just shows how it's definitely mm-hmm. a team effort when we do something like this.
Yeah, there are a lot of moving parts that have to mm-hmm. have to coordinate.
And it's again, always, the top of the trailer is actually the side of the trailer
now,
right? So it creates an
yep.
exit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. It's always great to have team members that are willing to go in with those animals, because I sure as heck wasn't about to go in there.
Yeah. Okay, so then what happened next?
Well, we were, in this case, we were able to successfully rescue the majority of the animals. I think out of about 170, I think we lost a total of 15. So for an accident of where the trailer is actually, flipped on its side, that's pretty good. Like mm-hmm. to save everyone, but that's not always possible. We were able to react and respond successfully because of the support and help we had. And then for us, it was an extraordinary training opportunity, too. These are situations where there are high safety concerns, there are high stakes for the animals, there are great opportunities to improve health and welfare, but we can't replicate training for those in the classroom. Everyone's a little bit different, and so these are opportunities for us to get our students involved and exposed, and then Keith has done an outstanding job of getting us involved in the after-action meetings and things like that, so we learn about the other components of the response, and those are things that we can pass on and teach and train.
So when you were out there, you brought students with you to help?
Yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And it's an interesting circumstance for those and a challenging opportunity for us. We have to keep them safe. We have to understand they're seeing what could be, a fairly intense situation for the first time, and then conduct some training, and while we're doing all that, expeditiously attend to what the animals themselves need.
Mm-hmm. And we're speaking with a number of folks here who were involved with a situation where a hog transport truck overturned out down by Highway 30 and 35, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of as an opportunity to demonstrate how emergency service coordination or emergency management coordination happens and what kind of emergencies bring various agencies together. And we're speaking with Keith Morgan, the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator, and Locke Carricker and Justin Brown from the ISU Veterinary Medicine, which played a role in this accident. Justin, what was your role in this?
Yeah, so actually I wasn't at Iowa State yet when this trailer rollover occurred, mm-hmm. but I have taken over instruction of one of the courses we teach to veterinary students since I've been here, and we actually had Keith come in and talk about emergency response, similar to what we're talking about today, how that works, how we will respond to trailer rollovers. Mm-hmm. So met Keith that way, had him come in to, like Dr. Carricker was talking about, speak with the students, because really no two of these incidences are the same. So all we can do is take the bits and pieces that we learn from each one and try to better ourselves for the next response. And so Keith came in, and then we had to respond to another trailer rollover not long after that, probably 3 or 4 months later, in northern Iowa. And so learned from that and have presented that information to our swine group again and see where we can learn and move forward there. So
what lessons were learned from this? Sounds like a pretty significant accident.
Well, from our perspective, obviously we get to practice triage and emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. We also learn how to interface with all the other organizations and responders that are involved, and that's a critical component. I think it's important for the students to understand that there may be additional priorities beyond just animal health and welfare in those circumstances, and that there are other folks who are working for those priorities as well. And
you mean like the road safety?
Road safety. I mean human health and safety. You know, some of these involve injuries to people, and obviously that has to be a priority. And so those situations, I think it's important for the students to understand how they get integrated into all that that's going on in order to be effective with respect to animal health and welfare.
Mm-hmm. So being a vet is not just dealing with animals, it's dealing with life.
That's exactly right.
And it's dealing with the world.
And it's a team effort, too.
So what actually happened to these animals once you loaded them up in a trailer? Presumably some of them didn't make it. But the ones that were okay, what happened with them?
In this case, these animals, I believe, were actually destined for market. And so they continued on, they continued their trip on to market. The animals that did not survive the accident then were, they were disposed of accordingly. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is great because we're very fortunate to have Iowa State here. These students that are learning these lessons secondhand, some of them are going out. They may be the only large animal vet for many counties around and not have the resources. So at least they won't be taking on one of these situations completely unaware of what goes on around it. So that's a great payback that we get from Iowa State and the emergency management community by involving them in these kind of events.
Mm-hmm. So it was an unfortunate incident, but at least it happened in a place that was more fortunate than others.
Definitely for me to have these kind of resources. Mm-hmm. And, again, it happens a lot more often than people really realize.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of respect for what you're telling me. I once myself came across a car accident in that exact same location, and it's no joke there. That's a pretty serious place to have an accident. Mm-hmm. And it's just very interesting. Keith, we're coming around to the end of the hour. Any last comments or from any of you?
I leave it up to you guys for any last comments.
Well, I think from my perspective, I just really appreciate the interaction that we have and the opportunity to use these situations. As unfortunate as they are, they provide outstanding training opportunities. So.
Another point on this was the producer was also very well equipped and actually had a response trailer that was a key part of this. And it just shows
the producer meaning the vendor, driving the truck?
The company that was responsible for the truck. And it just shows how it goes all the way across when it comes to emergency management. There's the first responders, there's other agencies, and there's the individual in the businesses.
So the truck driver had been trained as well how to deal with an accident?
He seemed to be linked in. The company itself had a response trailer that had some of this, the trailers and the equipment that we needed when it came time to. And also they brought their trailers for us to offload the animals very quickly. So
so they brought in more equipment than the trucking company did?
The trucking company did, which is fantastic. And that's what I really strive for, is for us to be prepared all across, each of us doing our part to be prepared if there are emergencies or disasters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for giving us a little bit of a view into, you know, what you guys do.
Something a little bit different than what you normally think of for emergency management.
That's right. Yeah, but it's a fact of the way we live.
Yes.
Yeah, and we've been speaking with Keith Morgan. He's the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator, and Drs. Locke Carricker and Justin Brown from the veterinarians at the ISU Veterinary Medicine. And let me see. There's actually a cart. The Veterinary Diagnostic and Production Animal Medicine. It's the real title here. And they've been telling us about a real-life incident that involved the complex collaboration between many emergency agencies in the area when there was a hog truck overturned out by the freeway. And Keith, before we go, your website?
It's we're on the Story County website, and all you have to do is go to the website and search for emergency management under the departments, and we're there.
Okay. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Susan Franson. Thank you for joining us. Earlier in the show, we heard a news roundup of Iowa news provided by the Iowa Informer. For more of that, go to iowainformer.com. We heard from John Pleasance and Sally LaPan from the Ames Jewish Congregation, Dick DeMoss from the North Grand Mall Farmers Market, and we heard from author Linda Bensinger McCann, who will be speaking at the Ames Public Library tomorrow at 7 p.m. about her new book, The Civilian Conservation Corps in Northeast Iowa.
Today's show was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, remember, you can hear KHOI live online at khoifm.org. You will also find a recording of this show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster is able to post it, with links to the guests and information you heard on the program.
And speaking of hogs, yesterday I was in a hog barn. There were no people there, but there were hogs, and they were listening to KHOI. They were listening to Roger Berger.
Music for happy hogs. Classical Sunday. Stay tuned to Democracy Now! From 8 to 9 a.m. with headline news at the top of the hour. And stay tuned for Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m., even if you're not in a hog.
Not in a hog.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.